Hi, it's Gideon Rothstein with a response of the day for the 27th day of Adar. One of the values of this project that I found for myself as we've gone along is that it has also introduced me, and I hope all of us, to important rabbanim, important rabbis of the past who we might not have ever known about because for whatever reason, their works did not become famous or they didn't become famous in any particular way, which doesn't in any way say they were or weren't great Torah scholars whose ideas are worthy of study. So it happens to be that I recently upgraded my Bar Ilan, and I, for a long time, didn't bother to upgrade because I said, I have so much here in front of me that I can't, I have more than I can already, you know, deal with and accomplish. Many years ago, I read a beautiful story written by a woman named Rachel Naomi Riemann, who has two wonderful books of stories that have great insight. She, unfortunately, she's from a grandfather on her mother's side who was a Hasidish Rav. I don't know if he was an actual Rebbe, but he was Hasidish, and he was a rabbi. He seems to have been a very important influence on her, but sadly passed away when she was a child, and she is no longer at all connected to observance, to Judaism. I mean, she's like a, whatever, she's like a multiculturalist and takes from all sorts of things. But she has this beautiful story about a child she once knew who loved small toy cars. And so she once got him as a gift this suitcase full, you know, 40, 50 of these toy cars. And the next time she saw him, she said that he wasn't playing with it. And she asked him why or something like that. And he said, you know, I don't know how to love that many cars. So I sort of felt like that, Lavdil, but I felt like that about my old Bar Ilan. There was so much in there already that I wasn't getting to. I didn't see a reason to upgrade. But then I had to upgrade for computer reasons. And so I upgraded, and boom, when I start doing searches for Tshuvot for this project, I find new people who I haven't gotten around to. So, for example, somewhere else, I forget where exactly, I'm going to get to a Tshuva of Aaron Cutler, and Mishut Mishnat Reb Aaron, the Reb Aaron Cutler's Tshuvot, were not in the old Bar Ilan. That's an important value-added process. And here, too, for the 27th of Adar, I'm actually cheating a little bit, because I came across a Shut Maharam Irara. Or Arera, I don't even know how to pronounce it. In Hebrew, it's Aleph Yud Resh Resh Hey Simon Pei Vav, responsum number 86. So the Bar Ilan tells me that Rav Moshe, and they in English spell it as A-R-E-R-A-H. So that would sound like Arera or Irera or Arera. So I'm not sure exactly how he's supposed to be pronounced. He was born in Salonika, Greece, in 5638 in 1878, which is a reminder that there was a Jewish community in Salonika. Meaning, when I think of Jewish communities in Salonika, I think of right post-expulsion, 1492, right? And for hundreds of years after that, 200 years, 300 years. But if you told me that in 1878 there was going to be a Jew born in Salonika, I would have said I wouldn't have realized that. His family are descended from refugees of the expulsions. And then he studied and taught Torah in several different frameworks in his city. I mean, there was still a live Torah culture in Salonika. You know what, for all I'm talking about this, there could be one today too, but I don't think there is. I just don't remember. I've never heard about it. So he taught and studied there. He moved to Eretz Yisrael around 1932, which is when he was around 54 years old, which is encouraging to people like me who have not yet had the good opportunity to make Aliyah, but there is still time apparently. And he became the rabbi of Greek Jewry in Tel Aviv. So later he's appointed to Bate Din in Tel Aviv. He eventually becomes the head of the Beis Din of Tel Aviv. He passes away in 1958, and his grandson, Rav Moshe Harari, which sounds like he's a grandson, it sounds like a grandson through the mother, because Harari is a Sephardi name, unless they changed the name Arira, and that was a Greek version of Harari. But in any case, his grandson published his responsa, and it came out in 2008. So we have these responsa of Rav Moshe Irara, and this one that we're going to see today has a 27 Adar connection. So because this is a person I never come across, and I haven't seen him in many other Tshuvot, and I'm almost finished with collecting the Tshuvot for this project, I thought it would be worth our while to learn a little bit of some of the ideas of Moshe Irara. There's not going to be anything astounding in this Tshuva. It's an interesting responsa, but it's an opportunity to learn from him. Let's also remember to thank Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hachhauser, and the OU for making the shiurim available to you. And now let's turn to our tshuva. The reason why it's from the 27th of Adar is because when he gets to the Psak Din, to the ruling, they talk about the fact that on the 27th of Adar of Tavshin Yud Bet, 1952, so then the respondent asked for a certification of a will. And so this is going to be an issue of a will. So it happens to be the way he constructs this responsum is first they give the case file, And they tell the basic conclusions, so we'll get to those. So we'll know the conclusions from the beginning, and then we'll go through some of the issues that were raised in the course of the responsum. The case is a contested will, and it's so sad, these situations, because contested wills, you know, money brings out, and I don't want to, like, pretend that I know the two sides to an equation, but money brings out, unfortunately, can bring out the worst in people. So in this case, an old woman had clearly passed away, apparently without children, and had decided, apparently, to bequeath her money to the establishment of an orphanage. She wanted the money to go, this is 1952, she wanted the money to go to build in Tel Aviv, or area of somewhere near Tel Aviv, an orphanage. And relatives were upset about it. So the mitnagdim, so the person who's looking for the ishur, so the person she had, the people she had dedicated to be the executors of the will, she had appointed and designated, is the right word that I'm looking for, she had designated to be the executors of her will, had come to the Beit Din to get an ishur, to get a certification that they can, you know, they can use the property in the way that she said to do so in her will. And relatives of hers were coming to oppose it. Now, it happens to be so something that makes me suspicious of the relatives, aside from the fact that they're trying to invalidate a will that she made in apparently her right mind, was that they each bring their own ba'i kochum. I mean, you can't have lawyers in Beit Din because halacha is very against lawyers. So they don't talk about lawyers, they talk about ba'i kochum. And ba'i kochum means representatives of people who come with their, like, power, what we would call in English powers of attorney. So it's like a lawyer, but it's their representative in court. So there's a niece from Bat Achot HaMenucha, a niece through a sister of the woman who passed away. Then there's a niece through a brother of the woman who passed away. Then there's a grandniece through a sister of the person who passed away. And there's a grandnephew through a sister of the person. So and each one of them has the named Ba'i Kocho. They have a separate attorney coming on their behalf. Now, it could be, for all I know, that in the Beit Din, you're required to have certain people for each person, because otherwise it looks like a lawyer. But in any case, so the person looking to the petitioner, Hamivakesh, the petitioner says that this woman, before she passed away, had assigned a will, and she established as the guardians over the property so and so and so and so, and they want to use the estate in the ways that she had designated out. And we're going to see, once we get to the tshuva part, the elaboration of what went on, and we're going to see all the back and forth. It's going to be very sad to watch, because as you watch it, if I were involved in the situation, would I have acted any differently than any of the respondents do? I have no idea. But as we watch it, it's just a sad family drama playing out. These people think that they're being left out of money that should be coming to them. And for all I know, it should have been coming to them. And they're trying to get it back. And then the other people are saying, but the woman said this is what she wants done with it. So the conclusions up front, so you don't have to worry that we'll get to the conclusions, are, and that's what he does in the tshuva. First of all, there have been some claim that the kinyan, the form of acquisition made to certify the will, had been insufficient. And there are halachic cases where, if an insufficient form of acquisition had been done, the will doesn't become valid to require the division of the estate in the way that the person who passed away had wanted it to do. But, says the Beit Din, under the supervision of Rav Moshe Arera Irara, that's only true when the person who was setting up the will had made clear that he doesn't or she doesn't want the will to take effect without a particular kind of kinyan, kind of form of acquisition. But if not, then if the mitzaveh, the person writing the will and establishing the will, had just given the orders, and then the aidim, the witnesses, decided to do an act of acquisition to certify it, but she had never made clear that she wanted that, then if that turns out to not be valid, I mean, the claim was, well, you did this, but that kinyan doesn't work, that form of certifying that this is what is wanted to be done. That form of, normally a kinyan is a form of acquisition. Here it's a form of making sure we all know and making it and stamping it and completing the act of setting this up as a valid will. She hadn't wanted any of that. So the fact that the witnesses tried to do it, and then you could argue they didn't do it in the right way, Beit Din says that's not relevant. Second point of the Beit Din is, if somebody writes in a will, this will should take effect mehayom ulachar mita or lachar, whatever, from now and later on. So you want it to start from now, because otherwise you can't, a bequeather, a person writing a will, cannot bequeath things after death. Torah doesn't allow, halacha doesn't allow after death. After death, nothing belongs to a person anymore. They're ownership of items on earth ceases with their passing. So the way you write a will is, I want these acquisitions to happen me'akshav. You don't want to do it right now because the person doesn't own it anymore. So you say me'akshav ula'achar, from now and after and for after. So their claim could be, didn't take still a full effect till then, and then what various things could happen. But the Beit Din is postulating that what that really means is the essential, the original items themselves don't become mine anymore, but the rights of use to them, those devolve after death. And that way, there's no worry about bequeathing after death, because you're not bequeathing anything after death. The item will always belong to them. It's that you have retained rights of use until then, and those rights of use are being relinquished after death, and that can work perfectly fine and perfectly well. Third sack of the Beit Din was, if somebody refuses to sign something, were that to be true, we're going to see in the discussions that it's not even clear that was true, but if somebody refuses to sign something, the Beit Din says, that does not demonstrate a desire to change one's mind about the will. Whatever the reason was for the refusal to sign doesn't affect the validity of the will if the signature wasn't necessary for other reasons. And what they say is, bepulat sheva taseh. Anytime that the person refrains from something, that doesn't actively tell us anything about what's going on with the will. Fourth psak is, if she writes that she's giving this to the guardians, to the executors of the estate, I think there was some claim that maybe the executors wanted the money for themselves, and that's why they're claiming that she said this, but if she gave it to them explicitly to do something with it, such as to build a house, an orphanage, so then that is not considered a gift to them. It's considered a gift to Hektesh, to valid purposes, to good bits of purposes, and therefore they can't make the claim that the executors have any financial stake in what's going on. You don't know, you could argue perhaps that they like the idea of being in control of such money, even if they're going to end up building an orphanage with it, because they get influence out of it, they get goodwill from the vendors that they use to build the. But that's the psak of the Beit Din, is it doesn't count as money going to them. Another issue that clearly had been raised by the petitioners, by the relatives, is that when you have a gift or a bequeath, a will that's done al minat on the condition that, so that doesn't need a tanai kafel. There's a halacha idea that to set a condition on something, to create an acquisition with a certain condition, we often require or like prefer to be what's called a tanai kafel. Tanai kafel means that you say, if this happens, then this will be true, and if this doesn't happen, then this will be true. And you want both sides of it. It's a whole discussion in the Gemara about why you need a tanai kafel. It does go back to how Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to the tribes of Gad and Reuven about how they would or wouldn't take possession of the land on the east side of the Jordan that they wanted. There's a whole halakhic discussion about it. We don't have to get into it now. But the claim had been, she didn't make a tanai kafel. She didn't make a double tanai. The Beit Din says, but in a case of an al-minat, so al-minat is always a question. Does that mean, is that the same thing as on condition that? If I say I'm giving you this al-minat, so the words were translated into English as maybe translated as on condition, whereas bitnai is, in the English, it's hard for me to think about how exactly to express it. I think a better way to say it would be that al-manat might be more like saying, I'm giving this to you, I'm doing this action, whatever it is, as long as this becomes true. Whereas a tanai is on the condition that. So as long as, I think halakhically the Beit Din is saying, doesn't mean it's a condition of it. It's a condition of it, but not a condition in the sense of a tanai that prevents it from happening. It's sort of the assumption is that will happen, but this must also happen. Whereas on condition is a stronger thing. To make an on condition on al tanai requires tanai kafel. Anyway, sixth psak of the Beit Din is that if you have a will that's been signed by two witnesses, so one witness claims something else, that's not enough. That's not sufficient because it's only one witness to invalidate the will, to raise questions about the will, such they would say the will doesn't get put into effect. Then the seventh issue, and this was, let's say you have stock or other items of value that are embodied in paper, so cash, stock sheets, bearer bonds, I guess, which in ordinary forms of acquisition, the way to acquire them is not just a transfer. So it couldn't be like cash in that way. It's like you can't do it usually with what's called an Akinyan Agav or an Odita, various ways of passing ownership of these items. So if she gave them to the guardians to the executors of the estate, and she gave them to them, that's good enough. They don't need an actual kinyan. There's no like formal kinyan issue there. Just the ownership, the possession of it should be good enough. That's what the Beit Din is passing. I think the family had claimed the fact that they now have it in their possession doesn't mean anything because she didn't make a formal acquisition of it. Another issue that had been raised by the petitioners was that we have halachic situations where the halachic conclusion is that the best way of handling a contested estate is to give it to the heirs, who are these grandnieces and grandnephews, or nieces and grandnieces and nephews. So the Beit Din says that's only true when the person who was making the bequest had said, do something good with the money. So if they just said, do something good with the money, then you give it to the heirs. That's the best thing to do with the money. But when the person who passed away had given specific orders or specific had made a specific request or bequest or command or demand that you build a certain institution with it, so then the fact that the relatives might claim, you know, we're poor, we also need money, so that doesn't matter, right? It's not that they have the prior claim even in the face of the person who made the bequest saying something different. It's that if we don't have any specific orders, then supporting poor relatives is a greater value because we're supposed to care about our family first. And why this woman didn't do it, nobody knows. It's not brought up as an issue, it's not discussed, but the fact that she decided to give it to an orphanage, that overrides this general halakhic principle that if the person who passed away didn't say anything, we give it to the relatives. There's also a Chatzim Sofer who had said, the Chatzim Sofer had said that if a person who's passing away gives all his property to Hekdesh, gives all his property to other good causes, but not to the heirs, the Chatzim Sofer had written that a Talmid Chacham, meaning a person who cares about halakha, about Torah, about the right way to live, shouldn't be part of executing that will. So the Beit of the petitioner say, see, here she is, she's disinheriting us. Chatzim Sofer says that Talmid Chacham shouldn't get involved with that. So that's coming to a Beit Din. They're all Talmidei Chachamim. They shouldn't be part of enforcing this will. But the Beit Din responds that was only about a Shchiv Mira. A Shchiv Mira is a person who's on their deathbed. And Chazal made this whole rule for Shchiv Mira that they're allowed to apportion their estates even without regular kinyanim because Chazal thought that would help their mental state and maybe help them recover from their illness or at least not increase their suffering in their ill state. So Chazal Sofer says it there. And the Beit Din is saying he said it there. I think they might mean that he said it there because he was worried. The Chazal Sofer thought that as a Shchiv Mira, you're in an emotional state, you're this, you're that, you may make decisions that were inappropriate decisions, therefore Talmid Chacham shouldn't be part of that because that's really not the way, ideally, the way to handle it. And there's a suspicion, and I say this because the Beit Din is now going to say, but if it was a Matnat Bari, if it's a healthy person who does it, who's not ill in any way, then we have no issue with it, and the Beit Din should be involved in enforcing that estate because the Bakayim Yachol Kol Adam Lasar Pishalo Kol Mashaber Sherotze. Because when people are alive and well, they can do whatever they want. So the Beit Din is clearly assuming and understanding the Chatam Sefer meant that when it comes to a Shchiv Mira, the Shchiv Mira does that and they disinherit all the family, all of their relatives, in favor of a Hekdesh, in favor of some holy cause, that we sort of worry that it's the looming threat of death that is leading them to think this way, and they're not fully in their right mind, they're not fully in their usual awareness, and therefore, Talmid Chacham should be involved in it. But in this case, that's not true. Last, two more pieces of psak from the Beit Din. A shtar tzava'a, a will, that the bequeather, that the person who passed away, gave to somebody else, and he told that person, I want you to take possession of this will on behalf of those who are named in the will, meaning on behalf of those who are going to get property in the course of this will. So that already is good enough to transfer the property, to transfer the rights to the people. Because in general, we say that people, you know, we do this, let's say, before Shabbos, sometimes people have the custom of, if they can't get a gift to their hosts for before Shabbos, they'll go to another family member and they'll say, you know, you take possession of this for so-and-so, and it's already there. So you're not supposed to give a gift on Shabbat. So I can designate somebody to accept something on behalf of somebody else. That's the principle of Zachin La'adam Shelo Bifanav. We can acquire some merit or credit for somebody else, some possession for somebody else because it's seen as a benefit to acquire things. Getting more stuff is a benefit. So here too, if the person who is about to set up an estate because they think they're going to pass away, if they don't, they give it to a second party on behalf of a third party. So in this case, let's say that she gives it to her lawyers and she says, I want you, by virtue of what I'm doing, to acquire these possessions on behalf of those I've named in this will, which will be the eventual orphans who will get that orphanage, right? So that works. Not only does it work, it works even if the person who acquired it then gives the will back to the original person. You might have said, and the petitioners, the relatives, are trying to claim that when the lawyers then give her the will back and she puts the will, let's say, in her safe in her house, they say, well, you gave the will back, that means you're giving back those rights. So the Beit Din says it's not true. They are leaving the document with her for her to watch and guard over it, but that has nothing to do with acquisition anymore because the acquisition was made on behalf of the beneficiaries of the estate. And then the last issue of tzedakah they come up with, if somebody says, I want this money to go to tzedakah, and this is not only a will issue, anytime, the money itself becomes already owned by the tzedakah, and therefore the heirs of the person who did that hakdasha, who dedicated that money to that purpose, cannot hold on to it because it's not theirs anymore. There's no way that they can hold on to it already, meaning it's not. And there you could, for example, imagine the heirs bringing in the principle of Motzi B'Chavira Lav Araya, that they could say, we are in possession. If the orphans want to claim something, they should have to prove it. So the Beit Din is saying, no. From the moment that somebody says, I'm dedicating this money to a tzedakah purpose, the tzedakah already owns that money, and that therefore will apply to also collateral that has been given for loans that are going to come back eventually to them. And therefore, all of that money should already go to the tzedakah purpose, and the heirs can't say, you know, we're in possession, you prove that we don't need it. So those are the conclusions that the Beit Din gives even before laying out what happened. So now in laying out of what happened, we're going to go much more superficially until we get again to halachic conclusions, because they go through the whole back and forth. So the first step of the back and forth is important for us to know, because that's where the 27th of Adar comes in. On the 27th of Adar of 1952, of Tavshin Yud Bet, the lawyer, who the woman who had passed away had set up to be the executor of the estate, had petitioned the court to certify the will and to agree to the appointment of the people she had named as the guardians, the apotrophosim, as the executors and guardians of the estate. So that's where the 27th of Adar comes in. This process of certifying this will starts on the 27th of Adar. She passed away on the 6th of Adar of Tavshin Yud Bet in 1952, and 3 weeks later, the lawyer is bringing it to the Beit Din to say, please certify the will. She signed the will the previous month, and she wants most of the money to go to establishing an institution in Tel Aviv Yafo, an orphanage in Tel Aviv Yafo area for poor orphans, and she set aside some other money for, you know, various people, including relatives. So the opponents were relatives, as we mentioned earlier. But in addition to them, another complication of these kinds of things, that there were the executors of the estate of the husband. Her husband had passed away earlier than she had done, and the executors of that estate came to Beit Din to claim that the furnishings of the house and pictures and other things in the house, which she had distributed in her will to various parties, so they say she didn't have the right to do that, because in the husband's will, he had given her the right to use it for the extent, as long as she's alive, but not more than that. So we're not really going to go back to that very much. That's a whole discussion of its own, but just an example of what can get complicated about money, unless we take a lot of care to be sure we understand what's going on with money, things can get complicated. So the petition is advanced on the 27th of Adar. They have a court case about it. They have a hearing about it on the 26th of Sivan. And the lawyers, the Bai Koach, right, the people with power of attorney for the various Dagdim, for the various opponents, claim a couple of things. First of all, they claim that when she signed the will, she wasn't really in her right mind. She didn't have de'at lula. She wasn't fully herself. She was, I think the phrase is non compos mentis. She didn't have the mental capability to sign a will and to know what she was doing. And the day after, Yeah, the day after she signed the will, she went to the hospital for the illness that eventually killed her. So it's in Shabbat, and then she was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. She was ill a couple of weeks in the hospital. Then she passed away. So basically they're claiming, so you see that she was already ill. So if she was already ill, she wasn't maybe able to sign the will properly, and therefore we don't have to trust the will. Another one of the relatives claims, and we don't think she understood the will because she wasn't fully in her right mind. And then he said, there's no kinyan. We already know that the lack of a kinyan doesn't matter to the Beit Din, but he thought that no kinyan was a problem. And he also said that there was a prior will, and therefore he wants to bring the prior will to Beit Din, because he wants to say that the prior will should have shown that she changed her mind radically, and that shows she wasn't in the right mind, or whatever it is. So that's what he claimed. They also claim, this lawyer also claims, that the people who signed this will, the witnesses of this will, have a stake in it, because it turns out the people who signed this will were associates at the law firm that the will says are going to have the executors, meaning partners in the firm are going to be executors of the will, and the signatories were people who worked for that law firm. So they're going to say you have a stake in it. You're part of the beneficiaries of the executor, of the fee the executor gets, all that stuff, and therefore you should be invalid as witnesses, and if you're invalid as witnesses, then the document is invalid. Another claim was that as part of a will, basically, you're right, of sound mind and body, right? So she wrote, Hinani bria bigufi, right? I'm of sound, I think she writes, I'm healthy in my body, which is clearly untrue. How do we know it's clearly untrue? Because the next step, because for half a year already, this is the point, I'm sorry, a year and a half already before she passed away, she had cancer. So she's going to go into the hospital the next day for a procedure. We're going to get to that in a minute in the response, in the tshuva. But how can you write a sound mind and body? Which I think is an interesting question. The psak doesn't really address that. I think the answer is sound mind and body just means I'm of sound enough body that I can sign this of my own free will, and I haven't yet lost my faculties. But it's a question, right? Person has a terminal cancer, but they're not on their deathbed. Can they write a sound mind, body, and a will? So that was the claim. Another problem is that she didn't know Hebrew, and the will is written in Hebrew. So how can you write a will in Hebrew if she doesn't know Hebrew? Right? So they claim that shows that there was undue influence by the people who are going to be designated as guardians and executors. Let's remember, guardians and executors get a fee out of this, and they get, like I said before, they get financial heft because they are the people who control, let's say, you know, $2 million in our dollars to build an orphanage or whatever it's going to be. But that there's a benefit to that. So they're not completely free of attachments, of conflicts of interest. That's what they're claiming. And then this responded, this person's lawyer is saying, also, there's much of the will is fine, but X and Y and Z items that are not being given to us, she always said she wanted to go to the heir, so that means that somebody got in the way of her and told her something else. Like certain apartment that they thought was going to go to them, that's now being given to be sold to build this orphanage. So, on the hearing, that's the hearing of the 26th of Sivan. So a hearing on the 30th of Sivan, meaning the first day of Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, another hearing, and there one of the witnesses on the will gave his testimony. He said that she would always come to this lawyer. She was a regular client of the law firm where he works. He was there at the conversation between the client and the head of the firm. The conversation was handled in Yiddish, which is a language she does know. It's worth remembering a time that people who lived in Israel, there were people who lived in Israel, I mean, there are today in the Haredi world, perhaps, people who lived in Israel who only knew Yiddish and didn't know Hebrew. But she said in Yiddish that she very much wanted her estate to build an orphanage, and in the orphanage they should learn Torah and also a trade so that these poor orphans can build a life. According to this witness, she begged they should agree that they should be agree to be the executors of the estate. She's very nervous about it. And the guy who eventually was named the executor of the estate says maybe she wants so-and-so, her relative, to be the executor. And she says, no, definitely not. And she starts talking about how they've mistreated her and how they haven't treated her well, and she doesn't want anything to go to them other than some furniture and some jewelry. And then she originally had said the apartment on Rehov Balfour, and then she changes her mind. So the picture you're getting is of a woman who, for some reason, has a change of heart about her relatives. And she says, and this witness testifies, that she said, now, I think this is all called hearsay, but this is what he's testifying, that she told the executor that she does want the apartment to go to the orphanage, and that she... and that she's upset about how her relatives have been treating her. Now, theoretically, you could say, do you let a momentary upset get in the way of the inheritance, but that's what she's telling these lawyers. The witness says, and we translated the will for her from the Hebrew into Yiddish, and he says, I did it, and then this partner in the law firm who is eventually going to be the executor did it as well because she didn't fully trust the witness. Then she signed there in the office in the presence of the two witnesses with no coercion, or this or this. So the witness is saying it was a perfectly valid will. She understood everything, and she did a Kenyan on it, and she did it, and she clearly wanted to do it at the time that she did it. The witness also says that he had spoken to her doctor, who said that the operation she was about to undergo was not a danger, meaning that as far as the doctors were concerned at the time, it's true she went into the hospital the day after the will was signed, but the doctors didn't expect it to be a life-threatening operation, even though she was of an advanced age, and it was needed because she had some gynecological issue. And so it was expected to be basically a routine operation for all that she had cancer, but it's expected to be a routine operation. After the operation, the doctor says that her condition is good, and then later, it turns out that she had a stroke, I think. Sorry, the word is shitsukhelki, which means partial paralysis. I guess I thought it was from a stroke, but a stroke is a shibutz, is a shevet. So anyway, so she gets partial paralysis, and by the time he gets to the hospital, she's passed away. But the point is that the doctor didn't indicate at any point that she was anything less than her full right mind. So the relatives will say that she had this. So it's true she had something called sclerosis, which means that she had a hardening of various arteries or whatever, and sometimes her concentration wasn't great, and sometimes she didn't actually know what was going on. But anytime you had a conversation with her and she spoke about an issue, she did. So that's all evidence that she knows what's going on. And that's from a later hearing from the 30th of Av, meaning there's hearings after hearings because of all these things going on. Our time is running out. And basically, the halachic issues we already discussed. And the point is that in all these situations, we've said the things that we've said, that if she gives a will, and there's reason to think that she intended a will, and you don't have to worry about the Chatam Sofer, you don't have to worry about Kinyanim. So that's the way the will goes. So that is a response of a day that I have assigned till the 27th of Adar for this poor woman who passed away, not poor, she was a very wealthy woman, who passed away with no direct heirs, who had decided to give it to an orphanage, and what goes on when the relatives think that other things should have happened with the will. So some of the halachic issues of transmitting money or not transmitting money in a will, that's responsible. Today, thank you to Rabbi Jacob Rahman, David Hochhauser, and the OU. Thank you all for listening. My name is Gideon Rothstein. My email is grotht@gmail.com. Have a great day.